Hi, I'm Laura.
Hey, I'm Stefan, and you're listening to Attributed, a podcast library by DreamData.
The purpose of it is to store and share all the knowledge that we have gathered across DreamData employees through our LinkedIn Lives, podcasts, and webinars.
The typical topics you'll find here can be stuff like marketing,
sales,
B2B ads,
operations,
social selling maybe.
They perhaps a little bit more excited than what I normally am for our guests, and that's not to say anything bad about our because I'm a big fan of the lady we have here. Her two books have been very influential about how we do things at DreamData. The person joining is you, April.
Hi.
Can you
it's great
say
to be
you're
here.
A famous author by now? I guess you can.
I don't know. That makes me a little uncomfortable. I never really thought of myself as an author. And, you know, I have an engineering degree. So, you know, author feels weird. But yes, I've written some books. Yep.
Very cool, April. I think for us in the small B2B tech communities, a lot of us know who you are. But for listeners who have never come across you before, what's that kind of 2-3 minute intro to yourself?
Yeah. So I spent 25-30 years as a repeat vice president of marketing at a series of venture-backed startups. I think I did 7. So the reason there's so many is 6 of those got acquired. And so through acquisition, I ended up running marketing and product teams at a bunch of big companies, including Siebel Systems, IBM, Nortel, to name a few. And so about 7 or 8 years ago, I made the switch from working in-house to being a consultant. And so now what I do is very specific. So I only do positioning work. I only work with B2B tech teams and generally kind of enterprise B2B, like big enough deals that they have a salesperson involved at some point in the sales process. And so, yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah, and I think you've become quite good at it.
Yeah, I hope so.
I guess my first question is kind of, what was that insight that made you realize that you needed to write the first book? Obviously, awesome. What had you like continuously come across that made you feel like that there's actually a book that is needed on this topic right here?
Yeah. Well, I started out in my very first job as a product marketer. And one of the things we did with the first product I ever worked on is it wasn't a very successful product. And so we considered just end of lifing it. And instead, we made a decision based on some customer information that I had gathered. We made a decision to pivot, or essentially what we did was reposition the product. And this repositioning was, you know, we just kind of messed around until we got something that we thought worked. And it ended up being super, super successful. The company took off. We ended up being acquired by a big company in San Francisco. And through a series of weird events, I ended up being the vice president of marketing for this new division. And so in this new division, you know, because we had so successfully repositioned this previous product, they gave me a bunch of other products and said, great, like do that same repositioning thing with those things. And I was like, well, I don't even, you know, we didn't really have a process to do it. Yeah. So I thought, you know, like thinking on my feet, I was just like, all right, I'm going to figure out how to do this. So I had a bunch of coffee meetings with really smart marketers that I knew. I read a bunch of books. The new company was a big company. They had an education budget. I went back to school and took a bunch of courses. And what I discovered is, although we talk about positioning as a foundational marketing thing, there is no accepted methodology to actually get it done. Mm. And that blew my little mind. I just assumed that we knew how to do this. Yeah. And I just hadn't figured it out yet. But what I discovered was everybody's doing it in their own special way. And so from that point forward, positioning became a bit of a specialization for me. So I was continually getting new products and people are like, figure out how to do this. I had done it a few times and gradually kind of figured out a methodology that was sort of repeatable. That I could do this over and over again. So in the later part of my career, if you hired me as the vice president of marketing, part of the reason you hired me is I could talk intelligently about positioning. And if you came and said, we think we have a positioning problem, I could describe how I figured we were going to solve it. So when I made the switch to consulting, it made sense to me to focus on that. It also made sense to me, like, I should write this down so that everybody knows how to do it, because it seems crazy that we don't know all know how to do it. And so it started out as a big blog post. And then it got longer and longer to the point where I was like, all right, okay, I think this is a book. And then it took me 2-3 years to figure out how to do a book. And then that's how the book came out.
Yeah, I think that's a really good story. And I can just tell by the experience we've had at Dream Data, just following the recipe in the book, that it's kind of this exercise that you walk a little bit around it, because why is this meaningful to do? Why should we spend time on doing? And then, you know, 3 months go by without you actually doing it. But once you actually sit down and do it, it can be, it's such a relief that once it's done, you know, kind of, who are we selling to? Why are we selling to them? What are we saying to them? How do they look like? Marketing knows who to attract. The sales team knows who they're trying to sell to. And the product knows who they're building the product for. But if you haven't made up your mind about these things, then everybody's just running out in different directions.
That's exactly it. So the positioning, in my mind, it's this really foundational thing. Like, it defines who's our competition, how are we different, what is the value we can deliver that no one else can, what is our definition of a really good fit customer, so that's who we're focusing our marketing and sales efforts on, what is the market that I intend to win. So it's hard to do anything without a good, crisp definition of all that stuff across marketing and sales. If you came to me and said, okay, let's do messaging on the homepage, I'd say, great, great. Who do we compete against? Yeah. What's our value proposition? Yeah. How do we win? What's our best fit customer look like? And we'd have to have really succinct answers to these questions. Most companies have an idea about the answers to those questions, and then those answers are not consistent across the organization depending on who you ask. Mm. So if you ask sales, who do we compete with? You generally get a very different answer than if you go and ask product, who do we compete with? Yeah. Because they're thinking about competition in different ways. But marketing, sitting in the middle, needs to get really tight on that.
Yeah.
And then sales and marketing should be in agreement in that, right? Because I'm generating leads, or I'm doing stuff, and then eventually this stuff ends up with sales. Sales should understand what's a good fit prospect versus a bad fit prospect. So in my experience, the definition of these things is not tight, and it is not consistent across the organization. Mm. So eventually where I landed as a marketing executive was, if I could get everyone together in a group, marketing, sales, product, the CEO, customer success, bring everybody together in a group and then work through some sort of an exercise so that we're not just all standing together in a room saying, I think people love us because of this. No, I think people love us because of that. Like, we need an exercise or a process to follow that, as much as we can, takes the opinions out of it. And then what we get is, we all get to bring what we know about the customer to the table together. We all get to have a discussion about it, and we all get to get in agreement and alignment on the component pieces, so that we come out the end and we're all singing the same song. We're all like, yep, this is who we compete with. Yep, this is our value. This is what we're going after. And then we can all go and do our separate things, but we're doing them in the same way with the same base level information.
Yeah, it's really, 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 really powerful. Why do you think this work landed on the marketing desk and not on somebody else's desk?
Because we care the most. That's why. Mm. So we care the most. Because we're trying to do a bunch of things that are one step away from positioning, which messaging is the obvious one. Mm. So we're building campaigns. We need to understand who the target market is for that. So every day we're doing a bunch of things that is literally one degree removed from positioning. Yeah. So we care the most, and we suffer the most when it sucks. Because none of our stuff works. If we are trying to build campaigns on mushy positioning, we will fail as a marketing department. So this became very clear to me early in my career. Like, I come in, I'm the brand new VP marketing, and if I look at this positioning and I don't have crisp answers to these questions, I can't build campaigns. Mm. Like, I can't do anything. I can't write messaging. I can't do anything. And so everyone in the company is like, go wave your magic, you know, revenue generation wand. Yeah. And you're like, man, we really got to fix this foundational stuff before we get there.
Yeah.
Sales, they're also close to this stuff, but they're in an environment where they can kind of dance around things. And, you know, if we're talking enterprise deals, they get more than one shot to talk at the customer generally. Mm-hmm. And so it matters to them a lot too, but it matters in a different way. And they don't even know what positioning is for the most part. Yeah. So they may have the problem, but they don't know the cause of the problem. On the product side, it matters, but product lives a little bit in the future in general. So product is thinking about where's the product going to go next and what do we want to build next and what does the roadmap look like and how do things fit together? And so they care a bit about the here and now. If they're smart, they care a lot about the here and now, but a lot of product teams are kind of oriented in the future. So positioning, in my opinion, is very much about how do we win right now? How do we win right now? Because it'll change. Next year, it'll change. The year after, it'll change. We're building new stuff. Our competitors are changing. But we're marketing and sales, we're very focused on the right now. But here's the problem. So if marketing cares about it the most, marketing can identify when we have a positioning problem. So it seems like, well, marketing should own this. The problem is that marketing doesn't have all the information they need to fix positioning. Yeah. We actually need input from the sales team. We need input from product. Ideally, we've got input from customer success and whoever else on the executive team cares a lot about this stuff. Yeah. So marketing can drive an exercise, but marketing can't do it in their own little bubble, because if they do, sales won't agree, product won't agree, CEO won't agree, and it won't stick.
Exactly. And it's pretty much what Anna is asking here. What's the best argument you've used to bring the team, sales, product, everybody, CS, into the table for alignment?
So the first thing is that everybody's got to agree there's a problem. If they don't think there's a problem, they're not going to agree to dedicating any time to fix it. So because marketing feels the problem first, usually, in my opinion, the best way to get alignment around this stuff or to get agreement to look at it is to go talk to sales, because sales feels the pain if it's bad and they just don't know how to name it. So what I would do if I was a brand new VP marketing is I would say, hey, I'm going to go, you know, spend my first week listening on first sales calls with the sales team. And in a first sales call, you hear it if it's bad. First sales call sounds like it. Customer gets on. You know, rep is like, okay, we're going to give you the demo, show you the thing. They get on and you'll get 10 minutes into a pitch and the customer will be like, whoa, back up. Stop. Go back to the beginning.
That's not on your website. That's not what.
Back to the beginning. Like, do it again. Like, I'm not sure. Like, just do it again. I missed something. And so you'll hear this confusion where the customer's trying to figure out, what the heck is this thing? Not why is it great? just what is it at a base level? That is generally a positioning problem. Second thing you'll hear is customers will compare you to things that you don't compete with. So they'll say, oh yeah, I get it. It's just like Salesforce. And you're nothing like Salesforce. You're not even in that market. And so there's something in the way the rep is talking about it or what they were exposed to in marketing that's making them think you're a CRM and you're not even a CRM. Mm. So that's a problem. And then the other thing you'll hear on first sales calls of the positioning's mushy is customers will say, yeah, I get it. I get what it is. It's this thing. Yeah, I get it. But I just don't get why anyone would pay for it. Like, why wouldn't you just do this with a spreadsheet? Or why wouldn't you just do this with my accounting package? It kind of works. So they get what you are, but they're not really understanding your value. So if I'm hearing that in sales, then I go for lunch with the VP sales and I say, hey, I'm stupid. I'm new here. But here's what I'm hearing in sales calls. Do you think that's common? Like, am I hearing something that you've seen? And if the VP sales says, oh, yeah, we get that all the time, then I'll say, you know what? In marketing, this is often a positioning thing. And so then I explain what positioning is. And then I ask the question, have we ever really sat down and looked at our positioning in this company? And the answer is almost always no. And I say, you know what? It's going to take a couple of days. But I think it would be cool for us to get the gang together and look at it, because I think it would really improve what we're doing in a first call. And if sales says, yep, then I'm halfway home at that point. Mm. Then what I do is I go over to product and I inform them. So I go over there and I'm like, hey, I'm sitting over those sales calls. Here's what I'm hearing over here. Do you see that when you talk to customers? Do you find that people think we're this when we're actually this? Do you find that people have like a first conversation, they're having a hard time figuring what we are? And if product agrees, now I'm ready to go to the CEO. Now I go to the CEO and I say, hey, I'm new here. I don't know this much, but I sat in on a bunch of sales calls. I heard this thing. And in marketing, we call this positioning. And I think it would make sense before we pour a lot of money into marketing campaigns and stuff, it would make some sense for us to just look at our positioning. Maybe it's fine. Mm. Let's just get the gang together and look at it. We'll need a couple of days. And the first thing usually the CEO says is, well, what does Amy over in sales think? And I said, I don't know. You should call her. Mm. Yeah. But I already got her. So he calls her and she says, yeah, you know what I was talking about? Yeah, I think it's a good idea. And then they talk to product. Product says the same thing. This is how you build consensus to even do the exercise in the first place. If I just walk into the CEO's office first week on the job and say, hey, man, your baby's ugly. No way. Like no one's going to say, yeah, we're going to give you 2 days, brand new VP marketing who doesn't know anything about anything.
That's funny.
No one's going to agree to do the exercise. So I don't have any political clout yet, but sales does, product does. I need to borrow their clout. That gets everybody in the room. Then once I get everybody in the room, you cannot just get them in the room and have it be a free-form discussion. That'll be a disaster, and it'll just be a battle of opinions. So you need to get everyone together in the room, and then you need to have a process to work through. Once I convince everyone to do it and I get them in the room, then I get a process to work through. Now we've got something.
That's super nice. I really love that anecdote with if people are not understanding why it's valuable and worth paying for, then you have really attracted the wrong people through your marketing. And you've done so because you've not figured out who it's valuable for, who's going to love the product and see the value and are willing to actually pay for it.
Right. I see there's another question, which I think is the same, which is like, you know, how do you get leadership, sales, product more on board for these kind of things? Like some of it's an internal like education exercise. And positioning is a weird concept. Like even marketers don't fully understand positioning a lot of times. And it's kind of an advanced marketing concept, which is terrifying really because it's so foundational. Mm. But if you can educate the team a bit on this is what it sounds like when it's bad. This is what it sounds like when it's good. This is what we mean by positioning. These are the piece parts. This is why it's really important for us to have our arms around the piece parts. You know, not to just sell my own book, but my book is it's a short, easy read. And if you can convince other folks on the team to read it, sometimes that helps people get the religion on this stuff. And then there's lots of like, I have lots of content out there, like, you know, talks I've done at conferences and short articles I've written that is sort of like the overview of positioning. You can point other people at the team to this stuff that is shorter and easier to consume. Again, it's a bit of an education process, Jim.
Yeah. You can also cherry pick from April's podcast, for example. If you're facing a lot of competition, there's a podcast on competition, then you could start feeding that to your sales team. And maybe that's the gateway drug to further.
Yeah.
April, so now we've kind of that whole intro to what positioning is, and I could just stay on there all day. But did you then become aware about, since another book was needed, what was kind of missing in the first book that you're trying to get around to in this new book called Sales Pitch?
Right. Well, after I finished the first book, it was a terrible experience just producing the book. Like writing the book was easy, but then you have this whole year and a half long production thing to get the book out the door.
Oh, wow.
And at the end of that, I said, well, that's it. That's good. I only have one book in me. I only know one thing, which is positioning. I've written the book. I'm done. No more of that. However, after I was working with clients on this stuff, and I've been working with clients for a few years before I wrote the first book, and then a few years after. And after I wrote the first book, we went into lockdown. So COVID hit, and I got very, very busy because a lot of companies were trying to do emergency repositioning on account of COVID. So I got a lot of repetitions in working with companies. And, you know, at this point, I probably work with 250 companies, you know, doing positioning exercises. There was assumptions that I made in the first book that it turned out were incorrect. And so the first big assumption was I assumed that a reasonably mature company would know how to build a sales pitch or would have an internal way that they agreed on for building a sales pitch. Yeah. So at the end of my first book, it obviously awesome, there's a question, how do you test the positioning? And I say, well, you just take the positioning, turn it into a sales pitch, get your reps to test it out with qualified prospects, tune it, and then, you know, and that'll validate that the positioning is working. And then if it works in sales, then we can translate it to messaging, and then, you know, we can all run with it. But in my consulting clients, when I said that, okay, well, you're just going to do it in a sales pitch, they'll say, oh, okay. Yeah. And then they go away and have no idea what to do.
Yeah.
So the vast majority of companies I've worked with have a sales pitch already. They have sales teams, so they have a sales pitch. Uh-huh. But the sales pitch falls into generally one of two camps. Either the pitch is some set of slides that has existed since the dawn of time. Nobody knows who first created it or what the, where the structure came from. And over time, it just gets tweaked. So every time we have a new release, we add a slide, or maybe once in a while, there'll be a big fight. Hey, this one at the end should come at the beginning. Let's try that. Yeah. But the structure of the pitch, there is no real structure. It just kind of, it's a pitch. It's been around forever. No one knows where it came from. And if you ask people, why do you do the company overview at the beginning? I don't know. We've just always done it like that.
Who cares about
it? So that's it. Right. So that's one style. The other style is there's no pitch at all. And what we're actually doing is a demo. And the demo is a product walkthrough. So there are 7 drop-down menus. We get the customer on the phone. We maybe ask them a few questions like discovery stuff. So what are you looking to accomplish? Some things like that. And then we just jump into the demo and there's 7 drop-down menus. And we walk through every single feature in every drop-down menu like they're all equivalent. And that's the demo. And we get to the end and then we say, so what do you think you want to buy? Which is weird if you think about how much energy and time and effort we're spending on the marketing side, getting just the right words and having that positioning be great. And we're working about storytelling and all this stuff. And then we throw it over to sales and what happens? Nothing. We're just features. So I'm telling customers of mine, hey, take the positioning, translate it into a sales pitch and go. And they're looking at me like, how do we do that? So when I was internal as a VP marketing, whenever I did one of these positioning things, me and the VP sales would sit down and build a new pitch. And the way we built that pitch changed over time. So when I started, I just used whatever the company had, and we attempted to make the positioning work in whatever the company's sales pitch structure was at the time, which a lot of those companies, it was problem solution. So we would talk about the problem. And the problem was always really stupid and vague. So we'd say, you know, I'm selling a database, and I'd say, the amount of data being created in organizations is growing exponentially. Oh. Yeah, no kidding. Then we jump into the product walkthrough. Product walkthrough.
Yeah.
Or so that was what I was using until I got this job at IBM. So I got this job at IBM, and I had to build a sales pitch there. And like everything else at IBM, they had big structures for all this stuff. So my boss came and gave me this binder. It's like this fat. And he's like, this is the IBM process for building a sales pitch. I'm like, you're kidding me. And then a 59-step process. It was crazy. And so at the beginning, I thought, this is overkill. This doesn't make any sense. Like, why are we? Ugh. Anyways, after I'd built a dozen or so pitches using this thing, I started to see the genius in it. Now, a lot of it was very specific to IBM. And IBM selling at the time when I was there, our deals were giant. 10 million plus deals, a small deal. So, but there were pieces of that pitch that I thought were genius. So one was they never started with the problem and they never jumped straight into product. They always started with their insight in the market. And that gave us a way to start the sales pitch that was really oriented around our point of view, how we look at the market. The other thing they did was they always painted a picture of the whole market, and they didn't just position themselves. They positioned everybody else. So they'd say, look, there's 3-4 different approaches to this problem. You could approach it this way, and companies like XYZ, they do that. Or you could approach it this way, and companies like this do that, and we approach it like this. And they'd have a big discussion with the prospect there, and that's where they do discovery. And I thought, well, that's genius. Now we have a pitch that actually incorporates discovery and not just positions us, but positions us in the market against everyone else. The other thing was that when they did talk about product, they never talked about features outside of the context of the value the features delivered. So they'd say, look, we have a database. There's 3 big value points of why you would pick this database. The first one is it's a platform for innovation because it's really open and it plays well with other things. Here are the features. got a great API. We got a bunch of standards we adhere to, blah, 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 blah. Mm, so yeah. They would never just jump to talking about the API. They talk about why does it matter and then tell you the features.
Yeah.
Anyway, long story short,
I think it's an interesting concept, which is also in your book, that what is the insight that you have. Maybe you can just elaborate a little bit what it means to have an insight or a point of view or whatever you want to call it.
This is probably the most difficult part to figure out of a really good sales pitch, is this opening frame setting with insight. And for a long time, I couldn't describe it to people. Like, I would have wrote this book 3 years ago if I could describe that to people. And even now, I don't know if I'm doing a great job, but I'll give you an example. So usually, if you look at your differentiated value and say, look, we're the only company on the planet that can deliver a combination of this plus this plus this, you can ask yourself the question, what does a customer need to understand in order to understand how important that value is? Most companies, the product was originally built with some kind of insight into the market, where the founder looked at the market and said, do you know what sucks? Databases suck because they don't do these three things, and they don't do these three things because most people think about databases like this. But if you're a small company or a big company or some kind of specific company, you need a database that does something different. There's this insight that tells you the current stuff has a bunch of shortcomings, so we need to look at this a different way. So we actually want to start our sales pitch with that. Can I give you an example? Because I think an example makes this work better. So I worked with a company. They've been acquired by Salesforce. The company's called Level Jump. They've been acquired by Salesforce now, so they don't exist. So they're a good one to use because nobody's going to get me in trouble if I pitch this one. So company that I worked with. So what they have is a sales enablement solution. Think training for sales reps. This is a terrible market, super crowded, all kinds of other folks in the market. Yeah. We did the positioning workshop with them. And one of the things that came out as a real point of differentiation for them is they were the only sales enablement product that's built on top of Salesforce. And so you ask yourself the question, so what? What's the value of that?
Yeah.
And the CEO explains to me, well, the real value of that is that you can now combine your sales training metrics with your sales metrics. And so you can look at how the training actually worked. Like, did it improve time to first deal? Did it improve time for the rep to make quota? So this is a really big deal, value. And so they sell to the head of sales enablement. And there's two ways you could do this pitch. You could do the pitch where you're just talking about features, and you would sound like every other sales enablement tool out there. You'd say, look, here's how you set up training. Here's how you distribute the training. Here's how you set up courses. This is how you track it. And then at the very end, you might say, oh yeah, by the way, here's how you track whether or not the training was working. So the flip side of that is that instead of doing it that way, you would start with the insight. And so I'm pitching to the head of sales enablement. And so instead of just jumping straight into features, I say, look, why is sales enablement so important? And I'm talking to the head of sales enablement. We all get it's important, right? Why is it important? It's important because every day your rep's not making quota costs you money. Every day your rep's not making first deal, it costs you money. And they have some great data about how much money it costs you. And then they say, so if you look at all the other ways to solve the problem, there are things that are content management systems, essentially. And all they do is make sure that your reps are getting the right content, which is great and important. But then there's these other things that are learning management systems, and they make sure that you can track who's done what training and all the rest of it, and set up courses and all that. But you know what neither of these things does? None of them lets you measure the impact of your sales enablement with sales results. And we want that, right? Now I give you the pitch, right? And now I go to the demo, and the demo is all centered on that one thing. So it's a really different style of doing a pitch. I'm setting you up for why my differentiated value matters. And then I'm making the whole pitch about that. Instead of saying, here's how you log in, here's how you set up training. Who cares? Every training system does that. It's not differentiated. No one cares. We should never be showing this in a demo.
No, it's a really good explanation, April. Again, you can also then paint the landscape. Once they buy into the insight, then you can paint how the landscape look and why you're the right, one.
The other thing I'm doing in that pitch is I'm putting baby in the corner, right? I'm saying, look, there's all these folks out here, and you know what? I'm putting them in a bucket, and they're CMS, because that's what they are. All they're doing is just tracking content. That's it. And so I don't even have to name the customer or the competitor. Yeah. I just teach the customer that. And then so half the time, and then I'll be doing discovery. So I'll say, what are you folks using right now? Are you looking at anything else? Oh, you're looking at those guys. Yeah, they're one of these. But you're looking at those guys. Oh, they fit in this bucket. Yeah. And so I'm not bad-mouthing the competitor. I'm just calling the competitors what they are. And I'm saying, look, like if you have a learning management system, learning management systems are great for doing things like compliance training. You probably already own one already, so it's cheap. You could try and do stuff in there. And if that's all you care about, that's fine. But if you have a lot of turnover in reps and you have new reps coming on, or you have a lot of new stuff that you need to train them on, you're going to have to be able to measure the results on this thing. And you can't do it with that. Can't do it with this other thing either. You can only do it with us.
Super good, April. Okay, so that's kind of why this book was needed. Then if people then, which they should, go buy the book, what is it that they will find inside? what is kind of the recipe that is being handed over through this book?
So it's similar to the previous book in that it's designed to be a sort of step-by-step methodology for building a sales pitch. So you have positioning right now, whether you worked on it or not, you have positioning. So you have at least a thesis on, here's who I compete with, here's how I'm different, this is the value I can deliver, these are the customers I'm going after, this is my market category. The sales pitch book helps you map that positioning into an 8-step sales structure with 8 pieces that starts with the insight. It then goes to competitive alternatives, pros and cons of competitive alternatives. Then we have our view of a perfect world, which is where us and the prospect get in alignment, where we say, look, a perfect solution would have these characteristics, right? And if the customer is right, then we pitch. And then the pitch itself is, we start with an introduction. Here's who we are. This is what we do. Then we move to differentiated value. So here's my points of value. Here are the features that enable that. And if we do demos, that's probably the demo. And then we wind up with proof. So we need a step where we show the proof we can do what we say we can do. Often a customer case study, but it could be other things, third-party validation, metrics, things like that. There's an optional step for handling an unspoken objection. Obviously, a rep is going to handle any objections that come up during the call. But sometimes we have big unspoken objections around, how hard is this thing to deploy? Or do I have to buy everything all at once? Pricing structure, things like that. So there's an optional step in there to handle an unspoken objection. And then the last step in the pitch is the ask. So what do we want? What's the next step in our sales process? And how do we get the client moving to the next step in the process? So it explains those 8 steps. And then it explains how to take your positioning and map it in there. So how do we get to those 8 steps?
That's very, very straightforward.
That's the idea. Yeah. It's supposed to, it shouldn't be that hard. The really hard step is this insight thing and getting your arms around this point of view. We're not used to thinking about pitches starting that way, even though lots of companies do start their pitch that way. But it tends to be very mature organizations that are really good at this stuff, know how to do that. But younger organizations or organizations where the sales function is not as mature, this is usually a new way of thinking about the pitch. So what we want to do is do the positioning first, make sure we've got that really tight, look at our differentiated value, and then we can often back out of our differentiated value and figure out the insight from that. So in the work I do with clients, we spend the first 2 days, it's a 3-day workshop, we spend the first 2 days working through the component pieces of positioning. And then on the last day, I usually build a draft version of the sales pitch to start with. And after 2 days of hearing people talk about the positioning, usually I know what the insight is by then. And so I'll map the draft version of the pitch, and then we'll get together and fix anything I got wrong or fix the parts we think are weak. But you can generally tell what the insight is. Once you really understand the differentiated value, you can understand what it is that a customer's really got to get their heads around in order to understand why that value is really important for them.
Super nice. Just before we do the last round of questions that people have written in, now you've built the perfect, or you think you've built the first draft for the perfect sales pitch. And I think this is a topic I struggle a bit with myself sometimes, is how do you validate messaging content, some that this on somewhat not so tangible stuff. What is the process you typically, what are the things you look at for, like, okay, now the pitch is at a good state?
So again, the first thing you want to do is tighten up your positioning. People will try to go straight to the sales pitch without working on the positioning. Sometimes that works if your positioning is really good. Most of the time, it's better to go back, start with the positioning, then map it in. So what we'll build is a storyboard together with this cross-functional team. And then marketing and sales will take that pitch storyboard, which is what I teach you how to do in the book, and then build the graphics, build the demo, build the script. And what I recommend is you take one salesperson and ideally your best salesperson, and that train that salesperson on the pitch.
Yeah.
And then have them do a bunch of test pitches on qualified prospects, and we see how it works. So in a sales pitch situation, we get a lot of signal. So we can see, is a customer getting excited? Is a customer getting confused? What questions are they asking? Again, are they comparing us to the things that we think we should be compared to? Do they understand our value? Are they excited at the end? Usually I rely a lot on my salesperson's sales acumen as well. So your sales rep knows if this is a better pitch than the old pitch. Once they're comfortable with the pitch, like new pitches are hard. So once the rep is comfortable with the pitch, if I've got my best sales pitch doing this test phase, after we've done a bunch of these and we tweaked it a little bit, usually I can go to the rep and say, so you tell me, is this better than the old pitch or not? If the rep says it's better than the old pitch, we call that a pass. Yeah. So at that point, I take that rep and I have them train the rest of the sales team because now they're comfortable with it. They know how to do it. We can record the rep doing it. We can use them as a resource to train the rest of the team. And now that I have that story, I can take that story plus the positioning and take that back to marketing, and marketing can then go build messaging around that so that what we're saying in sales and marketing is consistent.
Wonderful. Very low practical. How many calls does the salesperson need to do to, is it 3 or is it 10 or what number are you kind of?
It depends. Yeah. So usually we start seeing some patterns after 6-7 calls, but it really depends. If it's a lower price product and therefore we have a lot of variability in the kind of customer we sell to, sometimes we got to do a lot more calls.
Yeah.
But we have a higher volume of calls, so that's okay. So sometimes we need to do a lot more calls in order to validate it because customers are all over the place. If it's a bigger value deal, we tend to have fewer calls, but the calls tend to be more consistent because it's a more consistent target market because it's narrower.
Yeah.
And so with those, sometimes we'll see, you know, we'll do 4 or 5 calls and we'll be like, yeah, that looks good. We're feeling good about this.
Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, one question here from Andrea.
We do this one, but then I want to take this other one about the Zwora deck.
Oh, yeah, that's last. Okay, let's take this one first, and then we take last afterwards.
Sure.
So this is Andrea asking, how do you translate the positioning into a messaging document after it was validated? Do you have a template you recommend using? And then Andrea is saying she's enjoying your podcast and a lot and looking forward
to
season number 2. But the how do you take the positioning work and then put it into messaging frameworks?
So generally, our messaging is really oriented around the differentiated value. So when we do the positioning, that step where we're talking about differentiated value and how features tuck into that, that generally forms the base of our messaging. So if you think about a typical homepage, there's a tagline, there might be a sub tagline, and then you're jumping into, look, we have 3 main points of value, 1, 2, 3. We define that in a typical positioning exercise. In my opinion, a messaging deck's a really good thing to build, or a messaging document, because in there we can get agreement on boilerplate stuff. So here's the tagline, here's our 3 points of value and the approved messaging around that. Here's what features we're going to talk about in each of those points of value and the approved message around that. Here's our company 50-word, 100-word, 150-word description. You might have some standard boilerplate stuff around, here's a diagram we use to describe the product and here's the messaging around that. And is this the approved stuff? And so I like to get all of that in a messaging document, get everybody to approve it. And then anything we go to build, we start with the messaging document and it's 1 degree away from that. If we don't build a messaging document, the problem is we fix the homepage, and then when people want to do a campaign, they'll look at the homepage and then make a campaign, and then they want to do another campaign, and instead of going to the homepage, they go to the previous campaign, and the next thing you know, you have 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, everything is way, and then you get to like the last thing, and you're like, that's nothing like the messaging we started, and you'll get this message drift.
Yeah.
If we're always starting with the messaging document, then we're 1 degree away from that. Mm. I have a template that I don't know how useful it is, but I have a template in the templates that I give out. So if you sign up for my newsletter, which, you know, you can go on my website, aprildunford.com/books, and there's a sign up form for the newsletter, or you can go directly to the newsletter, which is aprildunford.substack.com. But if you sign up for the newsletter, in the welcome email that you'll get back when you sign up is a link to the templates. And so it's all the templates for both books.
Awesome.
Combined into one workbook. So if you want to sit down and do the whole thing all the way through, it's designed as a companion to the book. So it doesn't give you everything. You still kind of need the books too, but yeah. I think it's a useful resource if you're trying to figure out some of this stuff. And so there's a messaging doc template in there as well.
That's wonderful, April. I think it's the same as the positioning work. Like you run, when you're in this, like particularly in a startup, you just want to go out, run fast and do stuff.
Yeah.
But you'll find yourself stumbling across all sorts of things because you haven't done the
this stuff isn't easy. I mean, if this was easy, we wouldn't be having to write books about it and talk about it on the LinkedIn Live. We'd be sitting on the beach drinking out of a coconut.
Yeah. Okay. Let's bring up Lars here. So he's writing, people often bring out the Sora deck as the biggest pitch ever. How do you see that? And maybe, April, maybe you can just explain what the Sora deck is. And
so this was a blog post that was written 10 years ago or so, like it was a long time ago, and where the guy sits down and he has a coffee with a sales rep. Sales rep shows him this pitch, and the marketing guy goes, "Oh my gosh, this is the best sales pitch I've ever seen." And I always questioned that because I was like, "Man, I've seen a lot of sales pitches, and that is not the best sales pitch I've ever seen." But okay, maybe if you've not seen too many, the structure of that deck is very much the structure of a pitch deck for a VC. So it starts with this idea of there's a big change in the world.
Mm.
And this big change in the world is going to blow everything up. And there's going to be winners and losers. And you don't want to be a loser. And so the winners, you know, end up looking like this. And you want to be a winner. And here's, you know, here's how we're going to help you do that.
Yeah.
The problem with that structure for a sales pitch deck, it's kind of the way we pitch to VCs, because VCs are looking at a very long time frame. And so we can credibly talk about a big change in the world that's going to blow up all the leading companies out there. And we, three people in a basement, are going to be the last one standing. And that might be true if our horizon is 10 years. But it's missing a lot of things that we really need in a sales pitch deck. So the first thing is, starting with the change in the world is a bit like my example where I said we used to always start with the problem. The problem with the change in the world is that every other company sees that change. Like, it's the same. So it's me talking about the volume of data is increasing exponentially. Yeah, every one of my competitors can talk about that.
Yeah.
So there's nothing differentiating about the change in the world. It has nothing to do with us. It is external to us.
Yeah.
So I think starting with your insight in the market, that points to just us. Nobody else has that insight, just us. So I don't think change in the world is differentiating. Second thing is, the Zora pitch deck has no concept of differentiated value. None. It literally has a step that says, our features are magic gifts we give to the market. I'm like, what? No, our features enable differentiated value for the customer's business. So I don't understand a sales pitch that doesn't really orient around differentiated value. Now, if I'm pitching to a VC, they don't care that much. What they're looking is, how are you going to dominate a market?
Yeah.
And that's a different discussion. But what the customer wants to know right now is, why should I give you my cold hard cash right now? What value is this thing going to deliver? Because I got to justify it to my boss.
Yeah.
Well, I got to go to my boss and say, we're going to increase sales by this much. We're going to decrease costs by this much. We're going to do these things. If I can't express that to my boss, I'm not going to get the deal approved. Like, there's a reason Zora doesn't use this pitch deck structure anymore. They don't. So I don't think, so is there a narrow case where it might work potentially? Like, if you were only fighting against the status quo, so let's say my only competition was a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And there was nobody else in the market that was credible except me. Maybe I could come in and build that pitch and say, you know, the world is changing and spreadsheets are no good anymore. You're going to have to actually buy software. And I didn't have to worry about positioning against any other software platform or any other thing. Maybe I could get away with that structure. But the minute I had competitors in the market, then I'm in this situation. Why pick me over the other guys? And that deck doesn't answer that question because it pretends that there might be other competitors out there, but they're losers and they're all just going to magically get blown away because of market forces that are happening in the future. That's not a good way to win a deal right now. That market force hasn't happened yet. That change in the world hasn't happened yet. Because those companies exist and they're doing well. I'm not a fan of that structure at all. I'll tell you the other thing. I've worked with 250 companies. I've never bumped into a company that's using it.
That is probably good then. I just out of personal experience, I can say as well, like, what we got a little bit wrong in the beginning was this confusion between where do you want to be three to five years from now versus what is actually the market you're competing in right now. So I just want to cement that positioning work you do for who you're selling to today and tomorrow. And then you can have a vision, but that's not what you put in your sales decks and on your website and so forth.
That's right. So in general, customers are not buying you for where you're going to be in 5 years because they got today's dollars and they have to go justify it to their boss today. Yeah. And so if you come in with a pitch that says, oh, in 2 years, we're going to have this amazing thing, the most likely response you're going to get from a customer is, great, call me back in 2 years. Call me back in 2 years.
Yeah.
And this is dangerous because the data tells us that customers are very likely to delay deals. It is a very easy thing for a B2B purchaser to look at all the options in the market and say, I cannot figure out how these things are different or why I should pick one versus the other. And I don't want to stick my neck out and look stupid in front of my boss or potentially make a mistake and get fired or not get promoted or whatever. And so it's very easy for a customer to come and say, you know what, now's not a good time. And so if you look at the data on this, it's terrifying. So in B2B, 40 to 60% of B2B purchase processes end in no decision. And if you scratch down on the data there, it's not no decision because they decided the status quo was better. It's no decision in the majority of times because they looked at all the options. They couldn't figure out how to confidently pick one because they all look the same and the companies are all saying they're the same. And so they decide to just stick with what they've got because what they've got is good enough and kick the can down the road rather than making a mistake. So the quote from Matt Dixon, whose research proved all this stuff to be true, is customers are much more worried about messing up than they are about missing out.
Yeah. Okay, so Christian writes, I work in enterprise sales, and to be honest, all products in our field looks the same, the white man issue. All companies working with marketing data sounds the same when looking at a web page. It seems it is very hard for marketing to understand those small, very important details.
Yes.
How do you get around this?
So this is the problem. I would say a good percentage of companies that come to me say that. So they'll come to me and say, you know what our positioning problem is, April? We're just not differentiated. Like, we all sound the same. We all look the same. There's 1,000 options in our market. How do we stand out? And here's the reality. If you come to me and your company is doing 2 million revenue, 5 million revenue, 10 million revenue, every day you have customers choose you. They look at their options and they buy your stuff. So if that is true, there is a reason that they choose you. And maybe marketing doesn't understand what the reason is. And maybe product doesn't understand. Usually what happens is sales knows a little bit, product knows a little bit, marketing knows a little bit, CEO knows a little bit. We just got to figure out what that is. And so again, the beauty of doing a positioning exercise where we get everyone together is that everyone gets to put their stuff on the table. So it's true. We might have 90% feature parity with the other things in the market. But trust me, there's a slice there. And customers are making decisions based on that slice. And it might be something that marketing doesn't understand the value of it, that it looks like a small feature. Are they really picking us just because of that? And we need to hear it from sales that says, hey, yeah, actually they do, because this thing is really important if you're a company that looks like this. Or it's not important if you're a company that looks like this, but if you look like this, that's actually really important. A lot of times the differentiation comes down to triangulating between a bunch of things. So I'll have competitors over here, and my differentiation with them is this thing. And then I have competitors over here that do that thing. So that's not differentiating, but I have this different differentiator. And so the reason companies are buying you is not because of this thing, which technically isn't differentiating, or this thing, which isn't technically totally differentiating, but the combination, you're the only company that does both. And so a lot of times we're positioning around that, where we say, look, you get this if you go with these folks, and you'll get this if you go with these folks. If you go with us, you get both.
I think
there's a lot of times it's that, but people will be like, oh, we don't differentiate because, you know, these guys do that thing. It's like, yeah, but all these other guys don't. Then they'll say, yeah, but, you know, we have this other thing and these guys do that. Well, okay, but they don't do this. And so you have to, again, we have to figure out what is the full list of competitors? What have we got that they don't got, that they don't have? And then how do we translate that into value to get my differentiated value? And it's usually not one thing. It's often a combination of a couple things.
Yeah. I think it's the obviously awesome book where you also specify for people to figure out who their 20% best customers are. And
well, this
not,
is it.
Not like, listening not... to bad fit customers, but actually listening to the best fit customers.
It's super important, because often what you'll get to is, okay, now I have this differentiated value, but not every account cares the same about that value. And so the question then is, what are the characteristics of a target account that make them really, really, really care a lot about the value that only you can deliver? And when you do that step, often what we find out is, hey, we've been chasing a lot of accounts where we're just not going to win. Or we might get lucky and we win, and then they're a terrible account. Like, they're just disappointed because we weren't actually the best fit. And we managed to get the deal due to just brute force selling. But, you know, we've now closed a bad fit account and they're going to cause us pain forever. Yeah. So I think it's really important when we're doing this exercise, like you say, we have to think about not every customer in the land that we have, but the customers, we wish we had a pipeline full of customers like that.
Mm.
We think about those customers that really love our stuff, close really easy, really love our stuff. What do they compare us to?
Yeah.
And what do we have that's differentiating for them? And what's the value for them? And then we need to get really tight on this definition of a best fit customer, because generally we can't win everywhere.
Yeah.
But if we're really focused on a certain piece, we can say, yes, we can win here.
And I think particularly for us who are in a subscription space, really studying the ones that are renewing the contracts as well. And as soon as they sign that contract, we try to talk with them and ask them, why did you actually decide to buy this product one more time? Because if they say the same two or three things, that's probably what needs to go into your messaging.
This is actually a really good tip. A lot of companies I talk to get really hung up on the deals they lose. And so they want to do loss analysis. Like, why do we lose this deal? Oh my gosh, you know? And it's like, buddy, we're going to lose all kinds of deals for all kinds of reasons. Yeah. But nobody's doing win analysis. Win analysis is super important, because win analysis is how we figure out how to win. And there's lots of reasons people don't pick you that are things that are just outside of your control. Too small, too risky, too whatever. There's a lot of that stuff you can't change a lot. But if you really understand why people pick you, like, there's nothing better I think you could do in a marketing department than win analysis. After every win, you should interview that customer. What was the situation? What were you using before? What was the trigger that made you think you had to do something different? Once you did decide you had to do something different, how did you make a short list? What did you look at? What places did you go? How did you do your research? And then who's on the short list? And then why do you pick us? And then another question I like to ask is, why not the other guys? Because sometimes the other options got eliminated because they messed up. And it wasn't being great. It's about them being bad.
What goes into the battle card afterwards.
Right.
Well.
And all that stuff goes in the battle card. But everything else, like, we want to understand the whole journey from what was the trigger that made them wake up in the morning and say, we can't keep doing it this way.
Okay, April, wonderful advice. So right. Thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it. I can see the amount of activity. Also appreciate it. If people want to So I guess there's a couple of options. If they want to work with you, what do they do? If they want your books, what do they do? And if they want to listen more to you, what do they do?
Yeah, so aprildunford.com is the website. So if you're interested in consulting, that's the best way to reach me. But if you're just trying to get smarter about this stuff, a couple of options. One, the books are really everything I know about this stuff. So you could buy the books. I have a podcast, which if you like to do audio content, it's Positioning with April Dunford. You can check that out. And then I'm on LinkedIn, obviously, you know, sharing some things. And the newsletter is my newest thing. So if you want to subscribe to that, get some templates and do that.
Wonderful. Thank you, April, and thank you for everybody who's been listening. Have a great day.
We hope you like listening to us. Subscribe to our podcast and the ones that we have been guests on.
And if you have any feedback for us, just do let us know. And should there be a guest that you think we should be talking to, then like pitch us.
We're looking forward to seeing you.